Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict urges the faithful to pray for the church in China, which he describes as going through a particularly difficult period. Christians under fire. We talk to an Iraqi bishop and an Iraqi national living abroad about the fear and despair felt by Iraq's Christian minority after the Baghdad church massacre and the other recent targeted attacks against Christians. AIDS is still an emergency. With December the 1st being World AIDS Day, we shine the spotlight on the situation for sufferers in the African nation of Namibia, where HIV/AIDS is the leading cause of death. Pope Benedict urged Catholics around the world to pray for the church in China, which he says is going through a particularly difficult period. His appeal came at the end of the Wednesday General Audience, where he looked at the figure of the 14th century English female mystic, Julian of Norwich. Emma McCarthy reports.
This Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI launched an appeal at the end of his General Audience in a sign of support and solidarity with the Church in China.
Raccomando alle preghiere vostre e dei cattolici di tutto il mondo. La Chiesa in China.
Speaking to an estimated 8,000 pilgrims in the Paul VI Audience Hall, the Pope said, I commend to your prayers and to those of Catholics throughout the world, the Church in China, which, as you know, is going through a particularly difficult time. He continued by asking the Blessed Virgin Mary, help of Christians, to sustain all the Chinese bishops, whom he said are so dear to me, so that they may courageously bear witness to their faith, placing all their hope in the Saviour, whom we are awaiting. Pope Benedict concluded his appeal by entrusting all the Catholics of China through the Virgin's intercession so they may be able to live an authentic Christian life in communion with the Universal Church, contributing in this way also to the harmony and common good of their noble people.
Most Holy Father, among those present today from China, a group of faithful from mainland China.
Pope Benedict's appeal followed a catechesis centered on having faith in divine providence, even when it seems that evil prevails. This week, in his series of great female figures from the Church in the Middle Ages, the Holy Father's gaze came to rest on a very English saint, revered by Catholic and Anglicans alike, Julian of Norwich.
Julian is best known for her book, Revelations of Divine Love, which recounts 16 visions or showings which she received during a grave illness.
Considered one of the greatest English mystics, little is known of Julian's life aside from her writings. She was known to have lived during the 13th and 14th centuries, a time of great turbulence for the Church, rocked by a schism following the return of the popes from Avignon, and for her own country, which was at war with France. Even her name is uncertain, the name Julian coming from the Church of St. Julian in Norwich, where she was a hermit and mystic. Pope Benedict continued that Julian's writings exude an optimism grounded in the certainty that we are loved by God and protected by his providence.
As Julian says, in speaking of God's power to bring good out of evil, all will be well and every kind of thing will be well. Like so many holy women in every age, in spite of her withdrawal from the world, Julian became a much-sought spiritual guide.
The Holy Father concluded with the hope that in our own lives, we may be able to draw profit from Julian's teaching that God is love, which transforms our lives, bringing joy and peace to our hearts and through us to all those around. I'm Emma McCarthy.
What future is there for Iraq's embattled Christian community? Following last month's massacre at a Baghdad Catholic church and other recent attacks and bombings targeting Christians. The church massacre that killed 52 people and subsequent threats against Iraqi Christians made by Al-Qaeda has struck fear deep into the hearts of the remaining Christians in the Gulf nation. It also has prompted more than 100 families to flee their homes in the capital Baghdad and the northern city of Mosul over the past 4 weeks. The ongoing violence has confirmed some of the worst concerns of many participants at the recent Synod of Bishops for the Middle East in the Vatican, who warned of a continuing exodus of Iraq's tiny but ancient Christian community. Christians in Iraq once numbered well over 1 million, but hundreds of thousands have either fled the country or been displaced to the Kurdish-ruled region in northern Iraq since the 2003 US-led invasion. The Chaldean Auxiliary Bishop of Baghdad, Shlemen Waduni, summed up the mood of Iraq's embattled Christian community in the wake of the church massacre and the stark dilemma facing them: either flee abroad or stay and risk being killed.
The Christians are very afraid, and many of them, they are leaving. And this is a pity, a big pity. And we cannot tell them to don't go. We say, when they ask us, we say that. We need peace. We cry for peace. If there is peace and security in Iraq, I think our people will remain. And this is the problem. To solve the problems in Iraq, on the earth of Iraq, not outside. We need peace. We need job for our children. We don't want the army. All the people in all over the world, they must stop fabricate arms. So disarmament is the issue. UN, they must do that here in Iraq and everywhere.
That was the Auxiliary Bishop of Baghdad, Shlemen Waduni. Suha Rassam is an Iraqi Catholic doctor living in London who founded the charity Iraqi Christians in Need to provide support to Iraqi Christians who have been forced to flee their homes as a result of the violence and persecution in their homeland. She says Iraqi Christians are living in fear and despair following the massacre at the Baghdad church, which was the worst single attack against Christians in Iraq since the 2003 invasion.
It is a very difficult situation. It's a mixture of fear, despair, and at the same time, a sort of affront that this is our country and we want to live there and we want to stay there, come what may.
But have you heard of people who, after this upsurge in attacks, is now seriously considering leaving, even if they weren't before? Presumably there are some people who really feel they just can't stay there any longer. They're too frightened.
I have been speaking to Bishop Sacco. He's the Chaldean bishop in Erbil, and he told me that already he was in Sulaymaniyah dealing with 60 families who have come from Baghdad, and in Erbil about 80 families have come, and I'm sure to other villages people are already leaving. Although, as I said, I know many. One of them is a friend of ours who's still in Baghdad who say, I'm not leaving whatever happens.
Did you know personally anybody who was killed in that massacre in the Church of Our Lady of Salvation?
Not personally, but I know many friends here living here in London who had people killed, beloved ones, and people are really angry and dejected, and they see their fellow Christians, friends, carrying their bleeding cross, and there doesn't seem to be any resurrection in the near future.
And how many of the people in Iraq, particularly since the massacre at the church, have received letters or leaflets warning them to flee? I mean, do people there tell you that people are constantly getting warnings to leave the country?
There has been. 10 days after the massacre in Our Lady of Deliverance, there were 6 bombings in 6 districts of Baghdad with a high Christian presence and near Christian homes. And some of the 5 were killed in these incidences. And again, there were messages. When you get somebody killed like this, the message is that you will be next. So there don't need to be any other message than just killing somebody every now and then.
The Auxiliary Bishop of Baghdad, Monsignor Waduni, says one of the biggest problems is that Iraq is awash with weapons, and this is helping to fuel these attacks, and that Christians are, in fact, paying the price for this. This has not been talked about a lot, but do you agree with him, and do people there talk about the ready availability of arms?
Well, I'm not sure what he means by ready availability of arms, but there are factions, there are some extremists, and these can get arms from anywhere. And these are the ones that are causing problems. So if you are an extremist group with an agenda, and some of them have an agenda to empty Iraq of its Christians, then this is what they are doing. It's enough for one group to have arms and one group to have this agenda of emptying Iraq of its Christians for the Christians to be, you know, frightened and pushed out.
Do you think, in fact, then the Christians are being targeted purely for these ideological reasons, as you say, by these extremist groups who want to empty the country of its Christians? Or do you think there are also some venial motives or even political motives at play? Maybe they want to lay their hands on the assets of some of the perhaps more wealthy Christians who flee the country?
It is difficult to answer this. I mean, initially we were aware that when the attacks happened on the Christians, there certainly were some attacks that were committed by simple thieves who just wanted to put their hands, as you say, on assets. But these recent attacks certainly do not have this sort of characteristic.
The Iraqi church leaders obviously are hoping that the Christians will stay despite this situation. But if they are brave enough to stay, how can this problem of the violence, these targeted attacks, be stopped? I mean, the Christians don't really have any power. They've got no militia, and they obviously must be extremely vulnerable.
They certainly are the most vulnerable, together with other small minorities. There are the Mandaeans also, who are very peaceful and very vulnerable, and many have fled the country. The only solution is for a strong government to be formed and for this government to eradicate these extremist elements. I don't see any other solution.
As you know, a mass was held in St. Peter's Basilica to pray for the repose of the Catholics killed in the recent massacre at Baghdad's Church of Our Lady of Salvation. What has been the reaction to Iraqis living abroad like yourself to this solidarity that has been shown by certainly many elements within the Western community in the wake of the massacre?
It is very supportive to hear of these reactions. You know, we have heard of masses said all over the world, from Australia to New Zealand to Canada, Europe, all places. Wherever there is a Christian community, the people have come around, and the local Catholic Church has come around to mourn the dead, to support those who are alive, to support those who have suffered psychologically and who are still suffering physically. It is very, very important, but I think more should be done. I think there should be more sort of negotiation with the Islamic religious leader to produce fatwas to say that this sort of death is not a martyrdom for a Muslim. This is a crime. There need to be talks with the local Iraqi government and somehow to support their efforts in order to get rid of these elements. I don't know what else one can do, but I think governments should speak more loudly about these atrocities. I mean, I was surprised we had this news of this church broadcast by the media, but it was only in the radios. Very few television media gave the news or had interviews with people. 58 people are killed in such an atrocious way in a church in Baghdad is not frontline news. This surprises me. More should be said by governments to make people aware of what's happening to these beleaguered Iraqi Christians.
And do the Iraqi Christians there think that the situation could get even worse in the future, that these targeted attacks are likely to continue?
Well, just before this attack on this church, there seemed to have been a sort of stability. The last attack on a church was in July 2009. You know, I talk with friends in Iraq, and you know, they were saying that things are a bit more stable. There were blasts here and there, car bombs here and there, but that was targeting everybody, not targeting the Christians specifically. But after this massacre in this church and the followed by the attacks in these districts in Baghdad, I think the mood is very gloomy at the present time.
So how do you personally see the future of Iraq's Christian community? Can it survive there?
The only hope for the present time is their survival in the north, it seems, although this is not the best of solutions. The security situation in Kurdistan is relatively good, and they are welcoming the Christians. So for the time being, that seems the solution for it to survive in Iraq, and we hope that when the whole country becomes more stable, they can go back to their homes.
I was speaking to Suhar Rassam, an Iraqi Catholic now living in London, and founder of the charity Iraqi Christians in Need. December the 1st is World AIDS Day, and campaigners around the world came together on Wednesday to commemorate this year's theme, Universal Access and Human Rights. AIDS has killed more than 25 million people since 1981, and over 33 million people worldwide live with HIV, the virus that causes the disease. This makes it one of the most destructive epidemics in recorded history. A report released last week by the UN's AIDS Agency says the global AIDS epidemic has slowed, with a 20% decrease in new HIV infections over the past decade. But it says there are still 7,000 new infections each day. Sub-Saharan Africa is described as the epicentre of the AIDS epidemic and bears almost 70% of the global HIV burden. One small country in Africa where HIV/AIDS is a critical public health issue is Namibia. The prevalence of HIV there is among the highest in the world and has been the leading cause of death in Namibia since 1996. Father Richard Bauer is head of Catholic AIDS Action in Namibia, and I began by asking him why there's such a high prevalence of AIDS there.
Why it is open for a lot of speculation. I mean, certainly, you know, the poverty went into it, but we also think it was, you know, the multiple concurrent partnerships and the lack of circumcision here in Namibia. And both of those seem to be fueling the epidemic. But the good news is that we have gone from a high of almost 22% seroprevalence, and we're right down now to about 17%. So we're making some headway.
And what has been your reaction and the reaction of all the people out there in the church working for AIDS victims to Pope Benedict's comments on condoms and AIDS prevention as spelled out in the book about him, Light of the World?
Well, I think we're certainly listening, you know, and I guess I would even use the word hopeful, in that it would give us kind of one more arsenal for prevention, you know, especially with the many serodiscordant couples that we work with, where the husband or the wife is positive and the other one is negative, and to help them live a good marriage and yet prevent infection.
What age groups in Namibia are most at risk of contracting HIV? Is it young adults, or is it throughout all age groups and all sectors of society?
Well, Namibia may be a little unique. I mean, certainly, as in the rest of the world, there is, you know, the young 18 to 35. But then we're also seeing a spike here it would be older, given our lifespan, the over 45s, and especially in urban areas.
And what about the number of AIDS victims? Is it very high, and is it a growing figure?
You know, there are still new infections, you know, of people living with AIDS, but the rate of infections is slowly coming down. In Namibia, you know, our population is very small, just about 2 million people, and we think there's somewhere between 250 and 350,000 people living with the virus.
And how important is the role played by the Catholic Church and indeed the organization that you head, which is sponsored by the Bishops' Conference, in helping to care for those with AIDS, in helping to prevent it, generally providing a helping hand?
Yeah, we Catholic AIDS Action is one of the largest, you know, non-governmental agencies responding. And we are particularly providing those services in the community, and often in very rural areas and villages where there are no other services. So we're definitely going, you know, to some of the most marginalized in the country to provide that hope and services.
World AIDS Day this year was preceded by the good news that the infection rates for the disease have gone down globally by about 20%. But has this, in your view, led to a lessening of interest by the international community? Do you think that people now are saying, well, there's no need to give so much money because this disease is now under control?
I don't know if it's the news. I just think, you know, we're almost approaching, you know, 30 years of this virus, and I think people are getting tired of it. And with the good news of treatment, there's almost a perception that if people just get their pills each day, then everything is okay. And not realizing, you know, the complexities of this disease, that people still require support and care and supervision beyond the medical intervention. I think the world's become getting tired. Sometimes what I say is AIDS is no longer a designer charity, and it sometimes has gone off the radar, particularly with, you know, the global economic crisis.
And is it getting, as a result, increasingly difficult to obtain the necessary funding for the antiretroviral drugs for AIDS sufferers, which, you know, of course, are lifesavers there?
I think, yeah, in terms of the antiretroviral medication, we in Namibia haven't experienced a shortage yet. But many of the donors, again, are saying, well, then if people have the ART, that's enough. And yet many of the people we work with lack food security, children affected by this, you know, still need support. And so a lot of the ancillary services that are critical and essential are being cut.
And how much stigma is there in Namibia against HIV-positive people, or indeed people with full-blown AIDS?
You know, if you do surveys, it seems like the stigma is going down. But if you ask somebody, would you buy a loaf of bread from an HIV-positive woman, then you get a hesitancy. So it's almost like people are giving the politically correct response that, oh, it's okay. But yet I think deep down there's still a fear, and then that fear leads to stigma, and then the stigma leads to discrimination.
Now, through the course of your work, you must come into contact all the time with AIDS victims. Can you share with us, with the listeners, an anecdote or a story about one such person, be it poignant or inspirational and uplifting?
Well, I hope this is uplifting. The one I immediately think of is Jason. Jason was a young man that Catholic AIDS Action found maybe about 6-7 years ago, and we helped his mother die from AIDS. This was before antiretroviral treatment. His father had also gone, and so it was a family, kind of an orphan-headed household, we call it. And it was our volunteers that really supported this family, made sure they stayed in school, made sure they did their homework. And to make a long story short, you know, just through that little bit of help, Jason is now finishing his 4th year of medical school. And it wasn't a huge intervention. It was just, you know, moving beyond the stigma, offering a little support to this family to help them get over this. And now you have this quote-unquote AIDS orphan that will be a doctor in 2 years to give back to this community.
Indeed. And how is the future for anybody who develops full-blown AIDS, say, in Namibia? How does it play out? I mean, is it still all too often a death sentence there or not?
Gratefully, because of the availability of antiretroviral, we're seeing less and less of full-blown AIDS. That's not the case in, again, very rural areas where there's still significant people that just live too far from the clinic to keep going back and getting the refills. We're making big headway in that and coming up with new ways of having community nurses deliver medication to very rural people and task shifting some of what doctors did to qualified nurses. So we're seeing less and less of that, that the diagnosis no longer is so much a death sentence, but it is a sentence of lifelong medication, and that is going to continue to be a challenge. It's just not 6 weeks of treatment. This is medication for the rest of your life and supporting people to stay compliant with that.
And what would your message be to the rest of the world on this year's World AIDS Day?
Not to forget us. This is not over. I rejoice. I literally thank God every day for the advances that we've made. But AIDS is not over. And if we fail in our response, it's going to rise up and come back and get us. We just cannot let up on this.
I was speaking to Father Richard Bauer, head of Catholic AIDS Action in Namibia. Let's join our hands today. Among the many Catholic NGOs throughout Africa caring for HIV-positive people was one set up by the late Jesuit priest Father Angelo D'Agostino in Kenya. Nuambami means home in the Swahili language of Eastern Africa and has come to mean truly home for children in Kenya infected with the AIDS virus. Father Agostino chose that name for the first home he set up in 1992 to give food and shelter to abandoned HIV-positive infants in the capital, Nairobi. Following his death in 2006, his assistant, Sister Mary Owens, took over the task of caring for these abandoned kids.
Back in the beginning, Father D'Agostino began the Nyumbani home because he found babies that were abandoned by their families, just left in the hospital, mm-hmm. left to die.
That's right.
Do you still have infants coming to you in this condition?
Yes. Two infants came to us in 2008, both found on the side of the street. Thank God. The person who found them brought them to Kenyatta National Hospital, and then we were phoned and we took them in.
Do you have to say no sometimes that you can't handle anymore?
We wouldn't say no to something like that, but we don't have much space left in your banning home, though we've just taken in 10 more children recently because some of our children have moved on, so we're able to, we have a few more spaces.
Nyumbani founder Father D'Agostino had a plan to develop a village which would become self-supporting and which could be a role model for other such projects in other parts of Kenya and even other parts of Africa. This project is for children who have lost their parents because of AIDS and for grandparents who have lost their children. The village is made up of families headed by a grandparent. It is developing rapidly. And as well as a farm and primary school, this year a high school has been inaugurated.
It was Father D'Agostino's vision that we would have a village in every province in Kenya. And thank God, Archbishop Lele in Mombasa is in the process of building a village in Mombasa. But there are six other provinces in Kenya. And it was also Father D'Agostino's vision to move out to the rest of Africa. The idea was not necessarily that we would build the villages, but that we model this village and that others then would take it up. And it's my hope and my prayer that this will happen.
That was Sister Mary Owens, interviewed by Vatican Radio's Beth Hay.
Every day, someone is crying. Every day, someone is weeping. Every day, someone is suffering, suffering from the scourge of HIV.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.